Or the other kind of case is if I ask you a question and you don't answer, or if I ask you to do something and you don't do it, then I often report it by I asked him to do it and he did nothing. So these are the closest, the most plausible cases of somebody who's awake and not doing anything. And here you have, again, the actor, observer, critic comes in handy. You can say, from an observer's point of view, you always are doing something, because no matter what you're doing, an observer will count it as doing something. That is, he'll be able to give an action description that will fit. No, when you're awake, just restricting ourselves to when you're awake, an observer will be able to give an action description of what you're doing. In effect, he will hold you responsible for whatever you're doing visibly and can put that in the form of an action description. For example, if I ask you a question and you don't answer, I say he refused to answer, and his refusing to answer is what he did. That was his action. Or I can give an activity description. I can say, well, he was just sitting there enjoying himself. He's sitting there thinking. He was sitting there passing the time of day. He was sitting there daydreaming. And some of those will be more like the waking. The others will be more like sleeping. Then the next move is, if an observer can do it, then why can't you? And how likely is it that if an observer can do it, you're not? Isn't it pretty plausible that you too, under some description, are engaging in some action, even when you're just lying out there enjoying the sunlight? That's your action. So you can take certain kinds of achievement descriptions in and make it pretty compelling that some one of those achievement descriptions also corresponds to the action that the person is engaging in. And the burden of proof is on anybody who wants to suggest otherwise. But notice that that sort of thing stems from the phenomenon itself. It doesn't stem from introducing any postulates about it. It stems from the fact that, in fact, you have a hell of a time thinking of somebody who is awake and not doing anything at all, literally. If you raise the issue, well, what about, is it strictly necessary? You have your choice of a variety of answers, which are either going to be arbitrary or tricky. See, you could easily say yes and argue it. You could easily say no and argue it. And if you're really trying to do justice to the phenomena, you also try to do justice to the fact that you can that easily say either yes or no. And when you look at why you can easily say yes and easily say no, it stops looking simple. Anchor in a stronger. Look, start with somebody who just died. You say of him, you know, he's gone to the deep sleep. He's not behaving by lying there. Then take a weaker case where I poison you and you fall unconscious. And we wouldn't say you were behaving. Or take the case where I take a baseball bat and club somebody and they're lying there unconscious. And we don't say they're behaving. We say they're in this state, in this condition. And then add normal sleep, where it's a lot like those other cases, and missing some of the important features of, like here I am, I'm standing here talking. And my standing here talking is very different from my lying in a bed sleeping. When I'm standing here talking, you're getting different actions second by second almost. Whereas when I'm lying there sleeping, for maybe 6 hours. And during those 6 hours, there's not a whole lot that you can use to distinguish one behavior from another if you wanted to. You can distinguish, when I turn or how much I move or something like that. But that's not what you usually use to distinguish one action from another. Why is Well, partly because if I'm lying in the sun awake and enjoying it, if I wanted to, I could get up and do something else. And indeed, that's, you know, it often does occur to me that it's time to be doing something else. And so I get up and I go. No, it's the issue of motivation. Yeah, whereas if I'm lying here asleep, only in rare cases can I wake up at a predetermined time, especially if it's not my regular time. Secondly, it's hard for it to occur to me during the time that I'm asleep that it's time to wake up. And so I don't have the kind of control, motivation doesn't enter in to waking up out of sleep, or indeed things like turning or moving. If you ask why would he do that, it's hard to find plausible answers. So even though in certain respects being asleep is not all that different from being awake, in other respects it is different. And we usually mark that difference by saying, well, when you're asleep, you're not doing anything. Well, dreaming again is cutting the difference even finer, because normally we say, when a person is asleep, he's not conscious of anything. He's not seeing anything, he's not hearing anything, he's not feeling anything, he's not tasting anything. Whereas when he's awake, he's doing some number of these. And then you plug in dreams, you say, well, isn't there a case when even though he's asleep, he is aware of something? Yeah, but again, not in the way that one is when one is awake. See, also in dreams, you don't act with respect to what you have or what you're aware of in the way you do when you're awake. See, I can dream that a lion walks in a room, and I can dream that I jump out the window. But when I dream that the lion comes in the room, I don't go out the window. Whereas if it's a matter of waking experience, the lion comes in the room, I go out the window. So again, you see, there's enough of these important kinds of difference. So that we just normally say, no, you're not behaving when you're asleep. Well, keep in mind that if you're asleep, you're not in a position to give a contrary account, and that's one of the major differences. Yeah. It can be confusing. Because you can dream of waking up in the same way that you can dream of going to sleep. But again, there's so many important differences between that and ordinary ways of behaving that we simply mark that difference by saying, then you're alive, but you're not behaving, you're unconscious. Now, one of the ID characteristics, one of the powers that you retain while you're asleep is the power to wake up. See, when you're asleep, you also lose most of your ID characteristics. You're not a hostile person when you sleep. You don't have hostile attitudes. You don't have friendly attitudes. You don't have any attitudes. And you can't do arithmetic while you sleep, and you can't speak English very well while you sleep. So you lose a whole lot of your range of personal characteristics, but the one that you don't lose is that you have the ability to wake up under the proper circumstances. And because of that, this particular state still retains a continuity with your other waking states. And this ID characteristic retains a continuity with your other ID characteristics because it is of the same kind. Yeah. See, that was one of the issues we got onto last time. And then he asked, how do you handle it descriptively? And I said, via this analysis, a paradigm case analysis of waking versus unconscious, and that we did that when we dealt with ID characteristics. We said paradigmatically a person is somebody who engages in action, but if he's in a particular state, then he doesn't. And so that relieves us of having to say that a person is in principle always behaving. And then Bill asked, well, how come you seem to be saying that if you're asleep, you're not behaving? And that's how we got onto that. Therefore, they're not intentional actions. You still give performance descriptions of them. Many of them you can ascribe to some kind of learning. So you can give performance descriptions, activity descriptions. See, it's the motivational element that's missing. If I breathe while I'm asleep, I'm not breathing on purpose. Nor is my breathing a way of doing something else. So what you have is that you're able to give these deficient forms of description. And it's because they are deficient forms of description rather than simply a very different kind of description that you have the continuity from waking to sleeping. Better say some more there. I think that what you may have in mind, anybody see an eraser lying around here? Okay. Could you check across the hall and see if there's one? Just imagine the standard diagram for a social practice here. And then look at the range of options in move one there. Then compare that range of options. Thanks. Compare this range of options with the person's total behavior potential. But compared to his total behavior potential, this range is very narrow, usually. Now, why, under these circumstances, is it that narrow? It's that narrow because this is what he is already engaged in doing at the time when he starts here. If this is what he's doing, he's got to do it the way it's done and not some other way. And doing it the way it's done involves these options and not some others. Now, as soon as you get somebody who can't keep it together that way, which is the kind of thing that you run into in emotional and certain other states, then there is not the restriction imposed by this pattern on stage one. And so you have a larger variety of behaviors possible. What you were talking about sounded reminiscent of this kind of phenomenon.
Does the whole social practice hardwood options
or not? No. Individual differences show in how you select, which options you select. But it's public criteria that you're selecting this behavior is an option in this practice. See, I can't stand up here and go like this and say, hey, you know, I discovered a very innovative way to play chess. You can't get away with it. Okay, any other questions concerning existentialism or this? Okay, think of a social practice description as the paradigm of a pattern description. This specifies order, sequence, specifies options, and then it has the internal structure of elements, eligibilities, etc. And you would use this, for example, in saying that a chess claim took place or that a committee meeting took place or, you know, any of the familiar things. It would fit either this or some deficient form like a means, ends, or a task analysis of this. Okay, I said style, didn't I? No? This is what comes to mind now. This will give you a pattern. Now compare this kind of description of what was going on with all of the implications of structure, options, etc. With saying he acted nastily. That simply gives you a characterization in general of how he behaved, but it doesn't give you any pattern of behavior. If I say he behaved in an impersonal way, it still does not give you any pattern. It's simply a general characteristic. Now, if I say he sees the world in a very constricted way, that's sort of in between, because it's something more than just a general characteristic like being suspicious or acting friendly. On the other hand, it certainly isn't this degree of patterning. And keep in mind that a person's life does necessarily have a historical patterning, so you know it at least has sequence. And you can bet it has all kinds of others. So just to say that much of a certain way that a person sees the world is a long way still from pattern. But also, it isn't quite as uninformative about pattern as just style characteristics. And in world design, world design descriptions are somewhere in that in-between range. I said, in contrast, the modes of being seem much more simply categories or style. And keep in mind that if you push the pattern description too far, what you've got is a biography. Even a standard biography is far from a complete description in these terms of a person's life history. So too much patterning is not useful. Number one, because you can't do it, and number two, even if you could, it would contain a lot more information than you would want for any given purpose. And it's not surprising, therefore, that what you find is that in practice, the descriptions that are given are in the mid-range and not full-fledged pattern descriptions and not merely characteristics. That should serve to alert you about when you need one, when you need the other, and what good each of them does you. Are you sure I said that? It doesn't sound like something I would say. Guess why? Well, what do you have down that is raising a question?
Well, being the world is part of that concept. And the real world is. It seems like there's no discrepancy between the way you present the real world and being in the world.
That's right. No.
End of question.
Okay.
real world.
By the way, the fact that there's not a conflict doesn't mean that they're identical.
What, like, if there's any difference, I'd like you to highlight.
The difference is the whole conceptual system is different. And at this point, talking either way amounts to the same thing because it's responsive to the same considerations in the same way. But it's not the same concept because each of these connects to a whole different set of notions. See, it's like saying the concept of instinct is not the same concept as the concept of a conditioned operant, even though you can say they amount to the same thing, but they're not the same concept. And it's because of the connections to other concepts in the descriptive system that the notion of real world as we have it in descriptive does not lead you into the absurdity and despair things that the notion of being in the world has led the existentialists. And yet that difference is not just contained in real world and being in the world. That's a function of the whole system. Is there anything else in the chapter on existentialism that we would want to talk about that we haven't yet? See, I kind of picked off what seemed to me the major points of reference to give you handles on different aspects of it. Clearly, we didn't talk about everything that does get talked about in it. Remember when we switched from the developmental schema to the relationship formula? I said the developmental schema is geared to totality. All a person's ID characteristics and all of his circumstances, then you get a tidy formula of this sort. Whereas the relationship formula is a case of packaging this way. And that shows up with an unless clause. Now, since you are packaging this way, there's nothing contradictory to saying there are three main packages. There are three main kinds of relationship that a person can have. And then subdivide those further into more particular relations. The contrast is still between this way of packaging and this way. See, here the circumstances are separate from the person. Here, circumstances and some aspect of a person are together. And it's that kind of difference that the hyphen in being in the world is designed to remind you of. That you don't have something separate over here and something separate over here. What you've got is a phenomena of this sort. And once you have it of that sort, how you subdivide it doesn't matter. Because at no time are you ever separating these two halves. You're separating this way, but not this way. Yeah, the whole thing. And it's what subdivides into the three main relations. Well, if you think of people as visible objects, not disembodied spirits and not just bodies, but simply visible objects. If you think of a person as an individual with a history, in fact, if you think of a person as a history, then you've already introduced temporality and spatiality. Performances, movements take place in space and through time. And so a history of intentional action will require both space and time. Now, their main concern is to distinguish between phenomenological or psychological time and physical time. And they point out that phenomenological time is not homogeneous the way physical time is. And what they have in mind is if you compare physical time with psychological time, you can have over here 2 units like an hour, and over here the first hour seems like 6, and the second hour seems like 3 minutes. So that there's not just a straight correspondence between them. Then in terms of space, you have something that is at least reminiscent of Levine in his pathways. You tend to think not of a strict geometry in terms of coordinates. Rather, you think of things in terms of your access, your lines of access to them, and where you stand in relation to them. You don't just have a three-dimensional coordinate system and locate yourself somewhere there. You see things in terms of your lines of access, how important they are, etc. Now, likewise, psychologically, not you don't have a homogeneous field the way in geometry you have a homogeneous space. At any given time, some aspects of your world are standing out. For example, if you're sitting there thinking of where you're going to have to be at 3:30, that is already now standing out. That's part of your life space that's standing out. Whereas in a geometry, it wouldn't stand out any more than any other thing would stand out. In geometry, there's no such thing as standing out. Whereas in a person's phenomenological space, there is. And that's why a lot of this stuff is reminiscent of Levine. Because he has diagrams for a life space and for representing different parts of it, different relations to different parts, and different saliency or value.
But like to me, the causality seems to be a strong tenet, even though they may harden yourself to what's contrary, that doesn't make sense.
It's hard to present an argument because basically they don't. They don't argue against causality. What they do is show you that one can get along without it and not overlook anything. In the same way that Skinner doesn't really argue against ID characteristics except to say that they're of no value. What he mainly does is show you that you can have a system in which ID characteristics never appear and it's a usable system. So he says, well, you see, you can get along without ID characteristics. The existentialists do the same thing with causality. They have a formulation that at no place involves causality. They say, you see, you can get along without it.
There are no cause-effect relationships.
Yeah. But you see, saying that is not an argument. They say that, and Skinner says there's no such thing as an ID characteristic. But that's not an argument. That's just ideology. You know, I can stand here forever and tell you there's no such thing as a cause, and I will not have shown you anything. And they can repeat statements like that all over, and they do. And that's different from presenting you with an argument to the effect that there is or is not a cause, or that there is or is not an ID characteristic. Is that what's involved is demonstration, not argument. If they can show you a system that seems to be an adequate system and doesn't involve cause, that's better than any argument that says you don't really need cause. Well, how would you answer that? After all, you know, you're all supposed to be sitting in the critic's seat with respect to these theories. Do Do they really get along without cause? Does Skinner really get along without ID characteristics? See, what it reminds you of is another place where there is some leeway. Namely, what they don't do is talk about causes, and they don't talk about ID characteristics. Have they then got along without them? Okay. And that's something that is not easy to answer. Yeah. And that in turn depends on whether you think there really are causes or ID characteristics. See, because if you think that there really are, then no formulation that doesn't mention them are you going to consider legitimate. You'll say, yeah, they've stopped talking about it, but at the price of either talking about it in other terms or missing an important phenomena. Yeah. Well, does that mean that they're really using the notion of cause but just using different terms? Yeah. Well, it's hard because, as I said, and I said then, it's hard because they go together. And the places where they don't go together, there is such a thing as a phenomenological theory, which, because it's not a psychological theory, has nothing to do with existentialism. It's simply a perceptual theory. And perceptual, not in the sense in which perception is a topic in psychology, but in the sense in which perception is a topic in philosophy. In effect, it's a topic in epistemology. And you have a lot of theories of that sort that says knowledge begins with something sensory that is immediate, direct, and indubitable. And that's what you need to have for a foundation for all the rest of our knowledge, which is not either immediate, direct, or indubitable. That unless somewhere you have something like that, the whole thing falls apart. Now, notice how similar that is to the existential view, that if you have no foundation for your knowledge, all of it is irrational, none of it is well-founded. Well, this has been an idea that's present in philosophy from way back, that you always need a foundation that is secure in order for everything else to be secure. And when it comes to perception, what you need is something that is direct. Otherwise, you have an infinite regress and indubitable. It's guaranteed to be correct. You couldn't be mistaken about it. Now, this is the general way that the phenomenologists begin. They say you have to start with a given. The given is perceptual. The given is experiential. And so you have to start with a given, and you have to be able to wipe out all of the accumulated assumptions, learnings, etc., and just start with a given. And that's how you will then be able to have a foundation for the rest of your knowledge. So that's simply phenomenology with no reference to existential theory at all. It doesn't. They say this is a theory of perception, not a theory of action. Verbal behavior is simply something you hear, something you perceive.
Would I be safe in saying that the overlap is coming, the overlap does not exist when phenomenologists just take in sensory?
No. No, the overlap doesn't exist when the phenomenologist is not talking about behavior, when he's only talking about knowledge. And it's not that the overlap doesn't exist. You might say an existential theory contains a phenomenological theory, but not vice versa. And you have phenomenological theories all by themselves without any existential theory associated with it. And that's why you can distinguish the phenomenology from the existential.
It's knowledge rather than sensory.
No, it's knowledge rather than behavior. It's knowledge rather than people. A theory of knowledge is only a theory about knowledge. It's not a theory about people. It's not a theory about behavior. And it's not a theory about the world. It's a theory about knowledge. So you have a much narrower subject matter in phenomenology than you have in an existential theory that talks not merely about knowledge and experience, but also of people in the real world, etc.
Does the knowledge include anything other than sensory kinds of things?
Depends on the particular theory.
I'm talking about phenomenology.
Depends on the particular phenomenological theory, whether you extend the sensory experience to other things. For example, Merleau-Ponty talks about the phenomenology of language. Now, there's clearly something more in language than experience, and yet you can talk about the experience that goes with hearing or speaking. Just like there's more to a table than an experience, and yet I can talk about the experience of the table. There's more to the table than knowledge of it, and yet I can talk about knowledge of tables. So some theorists will extend this primary basis onto other kinds of knowledge, and others will not. And some of the extensions are attempts to show that this is the foundation for these other kinds of knowledge, others are not. No, you not only have phenomenological theories that are not existential theories of this sort, you also can have existential theories that are not phenomenological theories. Descriptive psychology. See, any theory is an existential theory in which you talk about reality within the theory itself. Any theory is going to be an existential theory if you talk about reality or the real world within the theory itself. The major difference between descriptive psychology and an existential theory is that descriptive psychology isn't a theory at all. But you could make one out of it simply by translating the conceptual connections into a body of statements. If you did, you would have something that would probably be categorized by most people as an existential theory. And it would not be phenomenological at all, because I'd be dealing with observation rather than experience. Right. Mm-hmm. What? I said it wasn't a theory. Yeah. And I added that the reason you can get along without phenomenology is that you use something that's even better, namely the concept of observation. See, and observation doesn't have the difficulties associated with the notion of indubitable experience. The indubitable experience is part of the foundation paradigm, the foolproof method paradigm. I said that in descriptive psychology, you have no foolproof methods, and you have no foundations, and you're not missing anything. And because of that, there's no place for that indubitable direct knowledge. It doesn't take that to make the whole system go. Now, one of the other features of existential theory is reflexivity. That one of the things that gets lost in traditional types of theory is the user of the theory and how he uses it. It's one reason why I keep reminding you of how hard it is within most of these theories to talk about yourself, to talk about self-knowledge. One of the items of self-knowledge is how you are using that very theory. Now, traditionally, the kind of theories we have don't attempt to do that job, because for that job we have a very different sort of theory called philosophy of science. Philosophy of science, you deal with the user of theories and how they are used. And because you deal with it there, you don't have to deal with it in your scientific theory. So you split the world up into this domain of people using theories to acquire knowledge, and over here into this domain of organisms acting instinctually or emitting conditioned operant responses. And that's the kind of separation that existentialists say there's something phony about it. He is exhibiting most of the distinctive features of people. He's thinking, he's using language, he's making appraisals, he's making value judgments, he's acting creatively. He's doing all of these things that you think of in terms of people, per se. And if all of that is contained over here in philosophy of science, well, then you don't have to have any of that over here in your instinctual behavior of organisms. Between the two, you may have covered the whole range, but in your technical theory, you have not. And so the traditional theories indeed haven't even tried, usually, except that there's always been that pressure that, you know, you're leaving out something important. And that's what creates that split that I've referred to so often. Incidentally, now that I think of it, I don't think I ever really mentioned what the way out of that split is. Remember, the split was between being scientific and saying about people the kinds of things that one says if one uses that kind of language, versus preserving in your scientific language what you already know people are like and have to be like. I said, typically this shows up in psychology or in behavioral science in the difference between seeing people as organisms and seeing them as people. And the further elaboration of that is that the notion of organism provides you with continuity to the rest of the biological world, and that in turn with the physical world, etc. Whereas there's the notion of an organism gives you continuity with all the other organisms and kinds of organisms, and the theory of natural selection that, if you trace it all the way back, tells you how you got organisms from non-organisms. And so there's continuity now with the entire physical world, with a little bit of fudging. Namely, you can't really do it now, but it's clear that in principle you ought to be able to. In contrast, things like thinking, feeling, imagining, experiencing, knowing, don't fit into this sequence at all. So those belong over here as characteristics of people.
But don't we have the notion, Pete, that Adam was pure?
Well, we also have the notion that anthropomorphizing is bad. Now, if you put it in terms of biological versus human, and say that's the form in which the split appears most overtly, and the issue is, do you give up the continuity with the rest of the world of biology, or do you give up what we know people are like? The answer is you don't have to give up either if you can get them somehow within the same logical framework. And these two do the job, because intentional action is what is common to people and organisms. You can speak of a dog acting intentionally with a little fudging. You can speak of an amoeba acting intentionally. All you do is give very deficient descriptions of their ID characteristics, the distinctions they make, the kind of behavior repertoires they have. You can perfectly well encompass animal behavior, even simple animal behavior, with a notion of intentional action. That's why the theories that we've seen that look upon people as organisms, why it's so easy to take their central behavioral concepts and translate them into the notion of intentional action. Because indeed, that notion gets at what is common with people and other species. On the other hand, this notion over here, I said, is paradigmatic of human beings, human behavior. It's deliberate action, which involves self-knowledge and choice and a basis for choosing and a concern with truth. And an unlimited degree of significance of your behavior. And, although we haven't shown it, language. So the notion of deliberate action enables you to get at and formulate in as precise a way as you know the distinctively human things. The notion of intentional action enables you to formulate what is common across the animal kingdom. And you can see why, in one sense, this is fundamental, and in another sense, this is fundamental. Say, this one is fundamental because, after all, this one is merely a special case of this, which it is. So if you didn't have this, you certainly wouldn't have this. If you didn't have intentional action, you wouldn't have deliberate action. So you can see why somebody might want to say that it's intentional action that is fundamental. On the other hand, you can also say this is fundamental because if you didn't have any of this, you wouldn't have any of this or anything else either. And that's your being in the world notion. That until you have an individual who distinguishes something and treats them accordingly, there is no such distinction and there is no such thing. Or if you want to water it down, you can say, if there were no such thing as this, this might be true, but nobody would ever know it. But that's weaker and in many respects unsatisfactory. If there were nothing of this sort, there'd be nothing of this sort either.
Seems that when you elaborate on what you mean by that, it comes down to the second point. Seems that when you elaborate what you mean by that,
No, the statement is there would be no such thing as intentional action.
Well, isn't that because we know what we're talking about?
No, it's because our knowing and talking and acting is what makes it the case that there is such a thing. See, the paradigm is the notion of a pawn in chess. So there'd be no pawns if there weren't people who played chess. The reality of pawns is parasitical on the reality of people and their doing the particular sorts of things that involve pawns. If that game had never been invented and were not now played, there'd be no such thing as a pawn. And that means literally there would be no such thing. It isn't that there'd be really be pawns somewhere, but we wouldn't know about them. If you think of all of the other elements of reality as simply distinctions that we make and act on, you have the same argument, and that's the being in the world argument. So in that sense, this is fundamental, because without it, there'd be nothing else either. So you have two different arguments that says, one that says this is fundamental and one that says this is fundamental. Each has its own particular importance, and neither contradicts the other, which is something that psychologists and other people have not seen. Because so far it has seemed to be that you had to choose one or the other as fundamental. And if you chose one, you gave up the other. Here you can see why you can say it both ways, and that it, you're not contradicting yourself, you're getting at something different in each case.
I still don't understand how intentional action connects with all organisms. I still don't understand.
You can take any organism and its behavior, and you can talk about it in terms of intentional action, and that people do. And we've seen that with the instinct and operant conditioning. The notion of a conditioned operant gives you the same distinctions, except with the addition of a cause-effect form. You can talk about pigeons, amoebas, or people that way.
Why do you use the word intentional?
The time when I first introduced it, it seemed like the most illuminating term. And I'm not sure that even now I could think of a better one. What I don't do is talk about intentions. In the same way that I talk about experiential learning, but I don't talk about experience. No such thing. Yeah. Not unless you want to listen to 15 minutes. Okay, think of the Freudian move in saying, well, there's no such thing as an ego or an id or a superego. What you have is id functioning, ego functioning, and superego functioning. But there isn't something called an id. See, that's just a possibly convenient but possibly inconvenient way of talking. You get right down to it, there's no such thing. So think of that kind of move in that kind of context of to get the general feeling for what the methodology is and what somebody is doing in saying there's no such thing. Because saying there's no such thing is not a way of denying that one functions in an ego way or an id way. Neither is denying that there is such a thing as experience a way of denying that one experiences tables and chairs. Right. So you know, it's the mirror image of saying there is observation, but not some indubitable direct perception. It's simply a way of chopping off those illegitimate endpoints that get you into trouble. Because if you can talk about observation, you can talk about seeing something or hearing it or tasting it or touching it or feeling it in the sense in which I feel it, you know, kinesthetic or anything else, you see. And that's how you make an observation, is you either see something, you hear something, you touch it, you taste it, etc. Now, if you categorize, you know, what's common to say seeing an ashtray and seeing a window and seeing the smoke out there, what do you come up with? Well, something like vision or seeing. But vision or seeing is not something other than seeing this or seeing that or seeing something. Division doesn't occur in the abstract. It occurs when you see something. The same way, you don't find colors in the abstract. You find blue or yellow or spots or something, but you don't just find color. And so you might say, there's no such thing as just color. There are blue things, yellow things, but not color. Color is a category term for things that exist. It's a term that marks a kind of thing that exists, but it is not a thing that exists. And so vision is a category term for a kind of observation, a kind of finding out of something. But it itself is not a separate thing that underlies seeing ashtrays.
Experience be a verb?
Well, experience is the category. If it's a verb, it's a category verb for seeing, smelling, tasting, touching.
But it shouldn't be. It doesn't exist as an animal.
Well, neither does it exist as a separate process. There isn't a process of experiencing separate from a process of tasting, touching, etc. That's the feature of category terms, is that they're not separate realities. They're ways of classifying. They're ways usually of classifying on the basis of common features. And if you cut across modalities, say what's common to seeing and tasting and touching, that's where you come into terms like consciousness, awareness, or experience. If I taste something or see it, number one, I'm conscious of it. Number two, I'm aware of it. Number three, I experience it. Hold up. Now, we have one more move in this development. Did we talk about non-committal language earlier on? Did we? Okay, well, see, now we take this notion of categorizing observations in terms of either vision or seeing, or at a higher level of experience, conscious, or aware. Now we plug that set of notions into this framework of an observer over here who observes this individual, who himself is an observer observing something else, and gives a description of it. And now you over here want to be non-committal. You don't want to agree with him. And neither do you want to disagree. You just want to hold hands off. And remember I said there is a wide range of language that's available, like belief or think or attitude or feel. One such term is experience. See, here I am over here, and here you are over there, and you say, I see a pink elephant. And I say to him, he has the experience of a pink elephant. Now, at that point, since there is no pink elephant to be had, the experience of a pink elephant now looks a lot more thing-like because it has to stand by itself. And so we have now introduced a new psychological topic, namely experience, which we can now research, theorize about, etc. Except that while it may be a topic in psychology, it's not a phenomenon in the real world. And if you were going to try to study it, you'd have a hard time locating it to study. But having common sense, you'd probably go back to people seeing things, hearing things, etc. See, you wouldn't, even though you've talked yourself into a corner, you'd probably do things that made sense. at least made some sense. Well, that's the abbreviated answer to how come one can say there's no such thing as experience. It may also suggest what kind of difficulties you get into if you introduce a foundation of indubitable direct experience. See, you can say that it is indubitable, but inevitably somebody's going to ask you, how do you know it's indubitable? And who's to say that his is? And then you're back into the same old difficulties, except with an additional difficulty. So, phenomenology, if you take it to include this appeal to indubitable direct experience, is not a way out of problems of knowledge. And that's not to say that if you start that way and continue on to various topics, you can't say interesting, important, and true things. It's just that that's not the way out of the problem of the foundations of knowledge.
Who do you say that consciousness is
No. Look, it's often helpful to look at the written formulations and then notice which terms do not appear ever there. And consciousness is one such term. Intention is another. Experience is another. So, in effect, I'm doing what I said that the existentialists and the Skinnerians do with cause and ID description respectively, namely showing you rather than arguing that you can get along without it.
What do you consider
the fundamental observation? Yeah, remember the maxim that says you acquire facts by observation. You acquire concepts and skills by practice and experience. And saying that you acquire them by experience is not to say that there is something called experience that you have. It's to direct your attention to a certain kind of learning. See, my favorite example there is to tell you that you learn certain things by rote is not to tell you that there's a certain something called rote which you have. It's simply identifying a certain kind of learning which we're familiar with and do distinguish. And the distinction is between first-hand learning and second-hand learning, between what I have to go through versus what somebody may tell me, or what I may read about, or what I may think about.
So when asked, what is observation, you would answer the way we acquire that?
I probably wouldn't, because I think that the asking questions that have that form, namely, what is an X, no matter what X is almost always a bad question to ask. Occasionally it's okay, but policy-wise, I'd say don't ask that kind of question because it's usually a non-question.
What would be a good question to ask?
Well, ask yourself, what is it we would want to know about observation?
I have so many attachments to observation as a fundamental that I have a hard time asking the question about that.
Well, that's okay. Observation is okay. But can't you think of anything to ask that doesn't have the form of what is X? For example, what kinds of observation are there? How do you act on an observation? What's the difference between observing something and merely knowing about it? There's a number of other kinds of questions that you can ask other than what is it?
Are you saying be more specific? That
no.
No. Because observation, the term observation is a myriad of things. So if you're specific, then you narrow it down to something.
No, that sometimes is an issue, but that's not it here. What's at issue here is that things are what they are and not something else. And therefore, in general, the answer to what is an X, the answer to that is, well, it's X.